It's that time of the year where all the spirits come out to play, where terror grips the streets and your darkest fears come to life. Pull in close as we journey through the darkness into the realms of the Monster Cast.
And hello, everyone out there in podcast land, and welcome back to the Front Row Podcast here on NPR Illinois, the podcast for people who actually like movies. And it's a bit of a bittersweet day here as we are recording the final Monster Cast for 2019, the final Monster Cast horror film spotlight. I'm Jeremy Gechner, the editor-in-chief, and with me, as always, my fellow cohort in all things Creepy Crawly, my wife, Mrs. Sarah Baltusevich Gechner.
What up?
Also known as the notorious SBG.
Yeah, that's my favorite nickname.
Yes, from our Are You Afraid of the Podcast. Fans have given you that name, and it's very appropriate.
Although,
I feel,
you know, it's weird to be recording Halloween movies when we should probably be recording Christmas movies.
No. Well, yes,
I mean, it's a winter wonderland.
For those of you who don't know, it was quite a snowstorm today.
Here. It's like 20 degrees of trick-or-treating in the snow.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, we're recording this one a little later in the night. We had some Halloween festivities and stuff to get to, and plus, man, October's just been a packed month for podcasts here on the network. It's been a very fun time, but we are so psyched to finish it off here with this Monster Cast spotlight on what I think is one of the better horror films of the last decade, what I think is one of my favorite films of the decade, and that
is barely in a decade. That's crazy.
I know, isn't it, though?
Man, we've been together for a long time.
For a really long time. Oh, God. Anyway, we are going to be breaking down here Drew Goddard's Cabin in the Woods, and this is just, I think, a phenomenal film in many different ways. But before we do that, do want to do just a really quick promo for our 500th episode coming up. We're going to be doing a live show at Anvil and Forge here in Springfield at 8 o'clock, November 8th, Friday. We're going to be doing a little retrospective and then breaking down Lou Hare's latest bracket for the greatest film of the decade. And it's already getting pretty contentious there. So if you're in Springfield, 8 o'clock, Anvil and Forge, free admission. Just come on in there and party it up with us celebrating our 500th episode. All right, Cabin in the Woods. So, Sarah, you said this one is barely in the decade. What, 2011 it was released, I believe? And I remember this movie just, like, took the horror world by storm when it came out. I mean, it was just so original in its concept and just so irreverent and also reverent at the same time towards the entire horror genre. When did you first see the movie? What was your first impressions of it when you first saw it?
I'm not going to lie. I did not like this movie when we first
watched this.
It.
I know
we
this.
We watched it at the first apartment that we had together, right after we got back together.
Right.
And you were like, thought it was like so great, and it got over, and I literally just remember going, what?
I feel that's a common, you know, thought about this movie.
I remember like it starting and me being like, are you sure you downloaded the right thing?
Yeah.
And like, it's just, this is like Moulin Rouge for me, because the first time I saw Moulin Rouge, I did the same thing, and I didn't like it, and I was like, ugh. But it took me, I was like, okay, I'm going to watch it again, I'm going to give it a little bit, I need to watch it with a different lens.
Right.
So after watching it two or three times, I've come to really respect what it's doing.
Right.
It's not. I'm not as obsessed with it as you are. I do think it's better than I gave it credit for to start with, though.
Right, and I came at it with an already built-in, not bias, I guess, but kind of just a built-in fan of the guys who made it. So it was written by Goddard and Joss Whedon. Obviously, Joss Whedon, geek king extraordinaire, and Drew Goddard has done a lot of great comic book runs as well. So I already had like the geek in with this guy, but. Yeah, this movie, you know, it took me a while to understand, because at first I thought it was just like a cool twist on like all of the, you know, typical horror film tropes, but I didn't really understand until we started watching it more as critics that, you know, the larger critique, the larger kind of satire that it's doing on horror films as a whole. And once I finally got that part of it, like, the film becomes even more brilliant to me. But we're going to get into all of that in a little bit. But yeah, I like this movie from the very start, and it's only grown the more I've watched it. So let's just give a very, very basic overview of this film. And honestly, the plot is pretty basic. Until we get
Evil
there.
Evil Dead first. Like, yeah. Our friends just going to a cabin.
Yeah. So five college students, played by Chris Hemsworth. Yes, that Chris Hemsworth. Kristen Conley from House of Cards. Anna Hutchinson from Spartacus. Franz Kranz, who I don't know much of what he's done, but man, he's got a fantastic name.
He's in The Village.
He's in The Village. In Training Day. What else is he in there that you're seeing? Anything of note?
I'm sure there are, but I'm just not seeing it right now.
Right. Well, anyway,
the Dark Tower movie.
But he is actually one of the best parts of this movie, yeah, is Marty. And then the last one, Jesse Williams. So these are five college students, or so we're supposed to believe, in 2011, heading out to a title of movie to have a nice little relaxing weekend.
Cousin's cabin. And
yeah, something like that. And you're right. Like, it is literally, it seems like a direct ripoff of Evil Dead. But what makes this so unique, even at the beginning, is that we're interspersed with these scenes of some kind of like corporate.
It starts with Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford in just like typical like lab.
It's like a corporate
lab.
They're
wearing just like white shirts and black pants.
Black
and,
ties.
They have,
yeah.
Name tags, and they're just like shooting the shit, drinking coffee at work.
Yeah, it's like water cooler talk about, like, you know, Bradley Whitford's girlfriend wanting kids, but like they're already starting like IV treatments. And,
yeah, but she's already like baby proofed the house.
Yeah,
and
so this,
you're right.
Like, this is the genius of this. When we first watched this movie, like, that scene started, and you and I both were like, did we get the right movie? Because this doesn't seem
like
anything.
Amy Acker plays like this like other like worker, and she comes up and she's like nervous about some big something that's happening.
Yeah, so like I think you said like a sweet. Has failed or something like that. So it seems like maybe they're in like energy or something like that. Maybe like some kind of energy company.
Scientific. It seems like some kind of lab.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's not. And this goes on for a good like 5-6 minutes to give you to the point where you're like, am I watching the right movie? And it's not until all of a sudden these big bright red letters, Cabin in the Woods, comes up that you're like, oh, well, I guess here we go.
And
but,
then it goes to our like teenager, high school, or college kids.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's basically every horror film you've ever seen, but because we have these intercut scenes, we come to learn that these kids are actually pawns in some kind of ritual that is being run and operated by Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins.
Right. And then you really start to notice, like, you know, that these kids are not like your typical kids in a horror movie.
Right. Yeah. So that's part of the genius of the film, is how it plays with the stereotypes and stuff.
Like the ditzy blonde, like she has literally just dyed her hair blonde like that day.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh my God, your hair.
And even that serves a purpose.
Right.
That's going to come up there.
Hemsworth is like obviously like the big sexy jock, but he's like also like on full scholarship to college.
Yeah.
He's like really smart.
Yeah, let's get into it, because like you're right. Like the key thing about this film that you have to remember is that as good as it is as just a horror film in and of its own right, you know, like just as good as it is at scaring you and at being like the common thing that we always
come
to
expect.
That's
not really what it is.
Yeah, it also plays with the stereotype so much, because this movie is actually a critique of horror films as a whole. It's actually on like, it's entire narrative is one giant critique of horror films, and one way that they play with that, you're right, is upending the stereotypes. Like, you know, Chris Hemsworth, he's just this, you know, obviously he's Thor, he's a superhero physique, like he's just this, you know, towering man, but like at the same time he's sitting there talking to Kristen Conley about like physics and metaphysics.
He's like,
and
don't read that one, read this one, it's better, you know. He covers that one in this whole lecture series.
Yeah, he's like, here, read this guy, it's by a Russian author, and he's like, he doesn't know by heart, he'll think you're insightful and stuff. And even more so, like, they have, like, he's dating Anna Hutchinson, and he's, like, you know, playing around with her in this, like, you know, who taught you about these books and stuff? And it's like, I learned it from you. And it's just really, really charming. Kristen Conley, she plays a college student that's dated her professor, you know, but she's had an affair with her professor, but clearly he's broken it off, and she's a bit heartbroken. And in the ritual, they call her the virgin.
Yeah, she's
and
like
so,
the virginal character, but she's not a virgin.
Yeah, exactly.
She just hasn't had sex since she broke things off with her professor.
And
so.
And the very first thing we see her is just dancing around her room in her underwear, which obviously all girls do, right? So.
And then Fran Kranz is Marty. He's this typical stoner.
Now that's the typical stoner, but he's also
really smart, too.
Yeah, he's an insanely
he's
smart person.
He's not just
person.
Like a friggin'. All I can think of when I think of a typical stoner is like friggin' Damon Wayans in Scary Movie.
That or Jason Mewes is who I go to, like Jay and Silent Bob. But
a horror movie, though.
No, but I mean, like, you know, he's the typical typical stoner. Like, he's just, you know, he's not as smart. But you're right. Like, Marty is actually really, really intelligent. And, you know, he's also really, really funny. And then
Jesse Williams is like the setup for.
Yeah, for Kristen Conley's character.
Dana.
We should probably, yeah, learn there. So Dana is Kristen Conley. Jesse Williams is
Holden.
Anna Hutchinson is
Jules.
Chris Hemsworth is Kurt. And yeah, where he said Franz Kranz is Marty. And so these five are, you know, again, we're playing with those stereotypes, but we learn that the way, like, there's this, some kind of ritual that is happening that needs to happen for the world to survive.
Right.
And we learn through
this. They're the center of it, and they're being watched.
Right, and it's because of the ancient ones, is what we're told.
We actually don't learn that till like the very
end. I know, but we're jumping around a bit here. You know, we're not just going straight through. So it's we learn that like this ritual is to appease some like ancient beings known as the ancient ones that are slumbering below. And if this ritual is not performed every single year, the ancient ones
completed.
Will arise and destroy the earth.
But the ritual is not just performed in America. It's performed in every country. So just one country has to succeed.
Yeah. And so the big crux of why everyone's nervous here is that literally only at the beginning of this movie, only Japan and the U.S. have, not failed yet. And even halfway through the film, we learn that Japan fails. So it's literally all in the U.S. And so what these kids find themselves in is literally every single horror cliche you can think of. But because they need to complete this ritual in a certain manner, they use things at their disposal like chemicals and chemical gases and pheromones and stuff like that to turn them into almost those stereotypical things we see in horror films. You know, Jules starts to get sluttier and sluttier as the night goes on. Kurt begins
dumber.
To like dumber, and he starts
Jockier.
Drinking a lot and like starts doing this alpha male stuff. Holden, even though he's like a college football athlete, is like wearing glasses and buttoning up his shirt all of a sudden. Yeah, and I mean, like, even Dana is, when they're sitting on the couch with Holden, she's just like, you know, like, I've never, she's like, no, I don't mean never, and stuff. So, like, these toxins and stuff, these gases that they're using are, like, kind of playing
with
their minds.
The only one that they don't affect is Marty, because you find out that his pot, like, counteracts.
It's kind of like, it's counteracting the toxin. But
basically what they do is they send them into the basement of this cabin.
Yes.
And they put all these different, like, artifacts down there, mm-hmm. and whichever one they choose, that one of them, each one is connected to a different monster or creature that is going to do the killing.
That will go up there and kill them in a fashion fitting the ritual.
And while this is happening, all the workers at this wherever lab are placing bets
on which monsters will emerge from this, which honestly
is
guys
the best part.
It's really weird to say, but I think I like the lab scenes the most in this
mm-hmm.
movie because and it's literally because I gotta say I'm a West Wing file, so Bradley Whitford can do no wrong, and I just think he's a wonderfully funny actor.
He's
but
super funny in this,
like pairing him with Richard Jenkins, these two are so freaking good together. I could literally watch, like, if you're listening, Godard, make a prequel just about them, like, doing the rituals in the past.
Like, because, how they got their jobs.
Yes.
And, like,
I would watch the hell out of that. But, yeah, these two, they're, like, just constantly joking with each other. They're constantly joking around with all the people.
And Bradley Whitford's character is named Hadley, and he always votes for the merman.
Yeah, he wants to see a merman really bad.
But it just never gets picked. So our poor kids end up choosing a diary of Patience Buckner, I think.
Yeah.
And that turns into like redneck torture zombies.
Yeah,
I think.
So they're pain worshipping redneck torture zombies.
This family of zombies that come up from the ground too.
And again, a really funny scene in the bedding when it's like, they chose the Buckners. This girl's like, I had zombies. He's like, yes, you did, but this is pain worshipping
redneck torture zombies.
Totally different species. And if you ever get a chance, just pause that board because
board.
Just look at how many creatures are there. And of course,
there's many throwbacks to like other horror movies.
Exactly. And there's a great video that we'll call out at the end of this that broke all of this down that was really insightful for us too. Because you're right, like the basement is filled with all these artifacts in this cabin, and we come to find that it's like they have to choose, you know, like it can't just be done to them.
They have to
some amount of free will in this, and then they must be quote unquote punished for their sins, so to speak. And that is really where the crux of this goes. You can figure it out. I mean, you know, they start getting picked off one by one.
They have to be picked off, and they have to be in a certain order just so that the virgin is last.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they said the whore has to be first.
Right, okay, yeah.
Then there's also, like, the jock, the fool, the warrior, and the virgin. And so, yeah, the whore has to be first, but then the virgin has to be the last one standing, and then her death is optional.
Right, you know, as like, long as she's the last one, it doesn't matter if she
and that play it. That of course plays on the horror film trope of the final girl, you know, like how, you know, sometimes it's you literally can pick out the girl at the beginning of the movie. Yeah, the Heather Langenkamp, the I can't even remember her name from Friday the 13th, but Nancy. You know, yeah, or, well, oh, that's Nightmare on Elm Street, but yeah, yeah, like, but you can like figure them out and
Sydney.
Stuff. Yeah, Sydney Bristow.
Bristow,
yeah. That's what did
alias.
I
get? It Sydney
is,
Prescott.
It is alias. Sydney Prescott, you're right, from Scream. So that's obviously playing on that trope as well. And yeah,
she's,
I mean,
a virgin too. She won't,
but there's like so many great great death scenes in this too from these kids, because I mean, like, Anna Hutchinson gets it the worst because she has to be first and everything. Yeah. But sexy here with Chris Hemsworth,
she's a whore.
She gets her hand impaled and then gets, I guess, her head cut off by a giant old rusty saw. That's where all hell really starts to break loose. We see Marty get pulled through a window and pulled off into the distance. We see Chris Hemsworth is probably
the best.
They
try to escape in their RV, and then he, like, there's a big gorge, and he tries to jump it with his, like, dirt bike.
Yeah, but
he like, clearly clears it, but he literally hits, like,
an invisible wall of some kind and just completely falls down. And you're right, the best part about that whole thing, though, is, like, he gives this epic,
like, I'm coming
speech.
Back with trucks and guns and cops and blah, blah. It's like this epic, like, rant about how, like, he's, fuck all this. He's, yeah, he's coming back. He's going to make it. He's made bigger jumps than this. And it's just like, bink.
Bam. It's like this, like, giant triumphant music, like, boo, 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 like, and then just, boom, like, just crashes down. And then, of course, Holden gets impaled through the throat as he's driving the RV back.
So they celebrate.
Yeah. So, I mean, they think, okay, we've got this, you know, like, everything is done and we're good to go. But unfortunately, they've overlooked one thing, which is yet another horror trope that they're playing on, which is, I'm sorry, but if you don't see him die on screen, they're not really dead, because Marty is not dead. And he shows up at the very end to rescue Dana. From it looks like the Undertaker sized version of the Buckner family here.
Mm-hmm, I guess Father Buckner.
Yeah, exactly. Marty has actually found a hatch that leads to an elevator in the woods. And so we figure out that this giant bunker that we've been seeing Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford is underneath this cabin. And not only that, but it's not just, you know, one monster there, but there's like this entire elevator glass housing unit of a bunch of different monsters.
They're all in cubes, and there's like hundreds of them.
Yeah, and once again, I encourage you to pause and look at all of these things, because there's so many callbacks. There's like the twins from The Shining in there.
It's like Hellraiser.
Hellraiser ripoff is
like
there.
The Sugar Plum Fairy. There's like Pennywise.
Yeah, there's a Pennywise in there.
There's a whole bunch.
Well, and obviously all these aren't, you know, the real things, but, you know,
they're
send-ups of those. But that's where we really get the carnage there, because, you know, they have to find a way to kill Marty before
they
kill Dana.
Them all out. They let them all
but,
out.
But, yeah, Dana, to try and escape,
carnage.
Literally just releases all of the creatures into the facility, and it is straight up bonkers how crazy this gets. And we'll get to the ending. Well, I mean, I guess we can, but because, like, you know, where
Bradley Whitford gets to see his merman.
Yeah, and then he gets eaten by him.
And then he snorts his blood out his blowhole.
Yeah, which is just terrible and stuff. But so through all of this, Dana and Marty are finally able to escape into the lower levels of this place, which is basically looks like this, like, granite or this, like, stone temple of sorts. And it is where we learn that the head of the whole operation is Sigourney Weaver, which
Ripley,
is...
Bitches.
I mean, again, just a great horror callback there. But
I'm sure
with
you
Ellen
hear
Ripley.
Her voice like earlier.
You do, but this is the first time we see her. But she goes and explains that, you know, the ancient ones sleep and stuff, and
created us, but they've been here long before us, and we've had to make these offerings every year. And if they're not satisfied, then they will rise up, their wrath out and kill us all.
Yeah, and so she's trying to appeal to Dana, because Dana has a gun in her hand at this point, saying, like, you've got to kill him, or literally everybody dies. And you know, Dana is looks like she's about to do it when Marty lets a werewolf come up behind her and attack her. And through Sigourney Weaver's trying to kill Marty at the same time, but she actually ends up getting killed. And so Marty and Dana kind of accept their fate that, you know, okay, well, I guess we ended the world. They share a marijuana. And then we see a giant hand come up from underneath the temple
and smash
the cabin and smash us in the process, the viewer. So, yeah, that was just a really, really big brief thing there. But let's talk a little bit about, because we talked a lot about what we like about some of these characters and stuff. But let's talk about that Carnage scene, because there's so many horror callbacks in that. There's so many horror homages in that scene. Which one do you think is your favorite of all of those?
I don't know. How do you say? I mean, it's so fast. It's hard to, like, remember everything. I mean, I think, like being impaled by a unicorn is pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
The merman's pretty clutch.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, that one's great just because, like, you know, Bradley Whitford finally
sees
it.
Literally, like, when he comes up to him and he's like, come on.
Yeah, he's like, come on. And then just starts getting eaten by him. And plus, like, you're at the blood spraying
everywhere. I mean, it's literally just, like, straight blood spraying for, like, a good 15 minutes of the film.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you blink, you'll miss something. Like, there's just so many. I don't know. Like,
yeah,
I always wonder, do the monsters, like, are they trained to kill them in a certain order?
I don't think they are, actually. I think that's why they have to kind of, like, you know, because, and you'll remember there's where, because, you know, like, when they separate them up in the cabin after the monsters are attacking, they lock them in their rooms, you know, they have automatic locks on them. Yeah, they put the bad decision gas in the air to make sure that they make the worst decision possible.
Right.
And even, you know, there's a point where in the basement, Kristen Conley, Dana, she is stabbing one of the creatures. And then even like that classic horror trope again of how like the heroes never keep their weapons on them. We see that Richard Jenkins like flips a switch and there's a little electrical impulse that goes through
the knife
and it makes her drop it kind of unbeknownst to herself. So again, it's finding clever ways to deal with all of these tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole reason for that is because, again, what we've been talking about of how this is actually a giant critique of the state of horror films at the time. Because the big metaphor that people get into here is that the ancient ones are a proxy for who? For us, the viewer. We, the fans of horror films, are the ancient ones. We're the ones who continually, year after year, go to see these same horror films, you know, see the same stereotypes, the same people dying in the same order and such. And, you know, when somebody tries to change that dynamic, it's often seen as something unsatisfactory, and the movie gets lambasted online or something like that. Or when something follows the formula too closely, it's the same thing. So it's always this fine line that horror film directors have to walk with the horror fan community. And that's, I think, a very interesting way to look at this film. I mean, what did you think when you first heard that theory?
I was like, what? I mean, I guess it makes sense, but it's also kind of like, that's reaching a little bit.
Well, I guess, but I mean, it's pretty cool to think of it that way. I mean, because you got to remember, like, ever since this film, there has been kind of a revolution in horror films, you know? Like, you think of Jordan Peele's Get Out, or, you know, Fede Alvarez's Don't Breathe, you know? There's been, like, this real big revival, and, you know, the James Wan movies and such. There's been a real revival of, like, serious filmmakers going into the horror film genre, and I think that that's probably because, like, the envelope is needing to be pushed, and I think this movie can be partially responsible for that.
Sure.
What? You don't agree?
I don't know. I think you're just taking it a little bit too far for just a horror movie.
Well,
I think you're going a little bit, like, I don't know. I mean, I get it. I think it's a nice theory, and it works just fine, but it's just a little bit like, it's a slasher movie.
Yeah, I suppose so. all right, well, look, guys, I mean, this is probably going to be our shortest monster cast of all time, but, you know, it's a pretty basic film, you know, in terms of, like, plot.
Yeah, I mean,
in
it's
terms
surprising.
Of, there's
like
great moments, you know, like, great performances. Like, we didn't get into every single little thing, but, you know, it's just a lot of fun. This movie is, especially if you're a horror fan.
Yeah, it's fun to watch. It's easy to watch. It's funny. It's got it just has a lot of things working for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, like, if you didn't have the aspect of, like, the lab and, like, the guys voting and stuff, it would be just your typical horror film.
Yeah.
But, like, that really adds to it. And it's it's just different. You're right. It's something different. It's something that we haven't seen before. And it's just a really fun horror film.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, folks, MonsterCast 2019 is in the books. That is it. We've had such a fun time with you this month. I feel like Sarah and I have not stopped recording since the beginning of the month.
I'm done podcasting for a while. I think we have a couple of Are You Afraid of the Dark Slime?
Yeah.
That we need to release.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
We need a break.
We have a lot of big life stuff happening.
Yeah, so. we're going on vacation, man. So, look, if you want to look back at any of the Monster Casts, of course, you can find us on frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. We've got so much stuff still coming up for you in November where you're going to get our reports from Ace Comic Con in Chicago and Wizard World Comic Con in Chicago. We're going to be releasing videos of all the interviews we did there and in St. Louis. We're going to be giving you your typical slate of shows. I believe that Discovering Star Trek is going to be coming back. Are You Afraid of the Podcast is still going with me and Sarah, and just your typical state of shows from the network. And of course, as I said at the beginning, our 500th episode live at Anvil and Forge in downtown Springfield. Make sure you are there. Free admission. Just come and party with us.
I have to be the babysitter.
Yeah, I guess so. What, Gibson can't come to the bar? Yeah, I don't know. All right, folks, that is going to do it. Once again, thank you for a wonderful MonsterCast season. We cannot wait to bring them to you once again next year with four more spotlights from the minds of Sarah and Jeremy. So for the Front Row Network, I am Jeremy Gechner.
I'm Sarah Baltusevich Gechner.
And as always, we'll see you in the front row.